I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City mayoral candidate Steve Miller is pulling out the big guns. He's got the endorsement of an old Rockhurst High classmate you may have heard of, former Hillary Clinton running mate Senator Tim Kaine. We'll ask the senator why he's extended his support and about a political crisis brewing back home in Virginia. Also today, if a picture is worth a thousand words, the work of black photographers in Kansas City has a lot to say about the African-American community here. We'll have a conversation with historian Delia Cook Gillis. She'll help us examine and explore a local photographic legacy, and she'll explain how it relates to the history of Kansas City's black community. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Powerful imagery of protests and violence helped bring attention to America's civil rights movement. Black photographers of the era broadened the nation's view while also capturing a wide range of social activities in the African American community. Local photographers such as William Fambro and Matthew Washington documented the African American experience in Kansas City, from church, school, and social activities to the realities of segregation and the struggle for equality. Historian Delia Cook Gillis highlights the work of these and other photographers and examines the history of Kansas City's black community through their lenses. Delia Cook Gillis is a history professor and director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Central Missouri over in Warrensburg. Delia, so nice to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City and welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here this morning.
Well, why are images important when it comes to, you know, documenting and understanding African-American history?
Well, for so long, we've not had much of a written word because of the institutions of slavery and the legalization of not having African Americans to read and write. We don't always have the same written sources as other communities. And so having the opportunity to explore the history through images and photographs gives us another way of creating a more complete narrative.
How frustrating is that for African Americans not having history that so many others of us white folks, just sort of take for granted?
Well, it's really tough, and it's tough for us to do the work, because even within the profession, when we find other sources, sometimes those are discounted, such as oral histories. But we work very diligently to make sure that any source that we use, whether it's oral, written, or visual image, meets the same standard. So it does force us to work a little bit harder and be more creative. At the end of the day, we are able to tell some of the stories, and the images do a lot in bringing to life those particular narratives.
You know, why would an oral history from an African American perhaps not hold as much weight as an oral history from somebody else?
Well, generally in the historical profession, up until really I entered the profession a quarter of a century ago, oral histories were discounted regardless of what group. In particular, we have the oral histories from the WPA projects, and those particular sources came under scrutiny because you could find two interviews of the same person, yet the interview would be a little bit differently. And I'll never forget when I was in graduate school under the tutelage of Dr. Dave Roediger, who's now in American Studies at KU, we went through those two, we looked at two interviews of the same person. But the interviews—
Seemingly conducted at the same time?
They were not conducted at the same time. They were conducted by different individuals.
Oh, okay.
And so it had an impact on the subject, the outcome of that interview, based on who interviewed them. And in particular, one interview was done by a white person and one was done by a black person.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the white interview, it was more, they were more they were nicer, if you will, about the comments that they had because they thought it might have been a government worker and it might have had something to do with benefits.
Right.
So they seemed to be more reluctant in their responses. And so we just have to interrogate those. We have to interrogate who is doing the interview, what questions are being asked. But it does not mean you can discount it as a source.
But photographs, getting back to our main subject here, that's a different story. I mean, a photograph is a photograph, and that makes them valuable, right?
That makes them really valuable, and photographs tell so many stories. And I also have my students look at what it does not tell you. So, yes, the photographs are very real, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share those with the Kansas City community so they can see themselves for themselves in the greater Kansas City narrative.
What don't photographs tell you? What can get overlooked in a photograph?
Well, sometimes we don't know who's in the photograph. At the Black Archives of Mid-America, there is a huge collection of photographs of the African-American community, but many times we don't know who is actually in the photograph. Mm. So when I published my book of photographs over a decade ago, I purposely included images where I did not know the names of who was involved, but those images told beautiful stories about graduations and weddings and church events. And so for that purpose, they were valuable. And over time, you know, we were able to name individuals and to learn more about the people who were featured, their particular stories.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about those two photographers I mentioned in the opening who documented so much of local African-American history, William Fambro and Matthew Washington. How easy was it for men like them to, you know, wind up becoming photographers?
Well, for African-American men prior to the Civil Rights Movement, it was difficult for them to do any type of meaningful work that was outside of domestic labor. In fact, in the African-American community, to be a Pullman car porter as a man was a very prestigious position. If you were highly educated, that was the job to have. So there were so many limits on job opportunities for men, despite their ability or their education. And the same for women.
And photography would be one of those hard-to-obtain.
That would be a very hard-to-obtain regardless because of the market for that. And so with these two men, what they have done by taking photographs of the community, they were entrepreneurs, if you will, and able to earn a living as well as doing us a great service by creating that body of work.
Do we know how these two men actually became photographers?
Well, we know a little bit more about William Fambro. It was something that he always wanted to do. Fambro was originally from Arkansas. He was not a native Kansas Cityan.
Mm-hmm.
He did attend the Kansas City public schools. He graduated from Lincoln High School and then went on to Lincoln University. He was also a World War II veteran. He served in the military for 3 years. As far as his photography career, he was a photographer for the Kansas City Call.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, if you will, his day job. But he also spent a great deal of time taking photographs of community events.
You also hear that during his time, some of his work would appear in the Kansas City Star, the newspaper where I've worked for many years, mm-hmm. but the paper didn't give him credit at times for his work. Why was that?
Well, that may have been just a part of the period that, you know, photographers were not recognized. But for an African-American, again, not to receive recognition for what they have contributed to American society is really part and parcel of segregation. So he was the Kansas City Call reporter, and therefore they posted, you know, there was a Kansas City Call photograph.
William Fambro, Matthew Washington, are they still alive?
No. But Mr. Fambro's son is still alive mm-hmm. and is a photographer, and he's spoken on his father, and he is a great resource. Again, besides images, being able to speak to community members and family members is a great way to kind of fill out the story.
I gather that both these photographers left behind their negatives, their contact sheets. There's an archive, if you will, of belonging to each of these men.
Yes. For Mr. Fambro at the State Historical Society here on the UMKC campus, there are several hundreds of his negatives that are there. At the Black Archives of Mid-America in the historic 18th and Vine District. We have many of his images there as well. And that's where I encountered the work of Matthew Washington, working on some projects with my students. And we came across these treasure trove of all these beautiful community photographs. And we started to look at the name on them. So at least they do receive credit in that sense.
Do we even know where these photographs were left? I mean, were they left in a garage? Were they left in a... do you know how the Black Archives came across them?
You know, I am not sure to the origin of the Black Archives. I know that there were specific donors to the images at the State Historical Society. There have been donors of some of Washington's images to the archives. But again, just working in the archives one day and just coming across folders of that. Another great source for images for these men is the Kansas City Call. The Kansas City Call actually still has in their possession many of the images. And Donna, who heads the newspaper, was very generous with me in allowing me to borrow photographs for my book on Kansas City. So there are many sources here. And I would encourage community members to look in their own collections. Mm-hmm. They may very well have Fambro and Washington images in their own personal collections.
I was going to say, the Call surely has thousands and thousands of images.
They're
sitting on their own treasure trove, if you will.
Yes.
What will happen with that someday? Have provisions been made for how we're going to get those someday into the public domain?
I don't know, but I hope the Call, you know, will make those available to the public either through a reputable archive or on their own. And that's something that I also want to share Sunday at the library lecture, is about preserving the images that you have, whether it's your personal family photographs or local institutions, churches, and schools. As a historian, as a teacher, I can only share with my students what we preserve. And if we don't preserve them, then they're lost.
You know, a lot of people are going to say, oh, these are just pictures of my family. These are just pictures of my son's third grade class. Why would those be important someday? What do you say to folks?
Well, you never know who they may become. You never know what their contributions. But if we want to look at our social history and the fabric of who we are as a community, they're important stories to be told.
Delia Cook-Gillis presents Through the Photographer's Lens. She mentioned this lecture at the library, Kansas City's African American Community. This will happen at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. Again, one of these photographers, Matthew Washington, you know, looking at his photos online from the Black Archives, it looks as though he was primarily a portrait photographer. There are shots of families, community groups, you know, youth groups and the like. Was that ultimately his bread and butter?
From what we've been able to ascertain, that's what I would say today. I've been working on his story for some time, and it's been really difficult to learn a lot about him. But again, those images are absolutely wonderful. And every time I speak on it, I'm just hoping that people that know him, who had their photographs taken, could come forward so we can learn more about his story.
I was going to say, William Fambro, you mentioned his son is still active.
Yes.
Does Matthew Washington, is his family around, or have you been able to find him?
I've not been able to find.
I bet you'd like to find him.
I would love to.
Yeah.
I would love to.
Where did you find the images that you'll be talking about on Sunday at 2 at the Downtown Public Library?
Well, they come from a variety of sources, whether the Black Archives of Mid-America, where I served on the board for 8 years, from the State Historical Society. Also, some of the images come from the Library of Congress. They come from the Schomburg at the New York Public Library. Those are some of my favorite images. They are images of the Paseo and the grand opening of the Paseo Y, which is now the John Buck O'Neill Education Center. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Kansas City historically had such a huge place in the national story, the fact that I could find images about Kansas City and some of the major archives in the nation was one of the really nice things about putting the book together.
Huh. The focus will be on Kansas City's African-American community through photographs, obviously. Who are some of the most significant people from that community that you've come across here?
Oh my gosh, Kansas City's history is so rich. And even the names that we are very familiar with, you can learn so much more about them. Ada and Chester Franklin are extremely significant in Kansas City's history. Minnie Crosswhite, the first social worker. There are just so many stories and stories that have yet to be told of Kansas City's working class and of our local social organizations.
How far back were you able to go?
I was actually able to go back to the slavery period and to find images of slaves in the Kansas City metropolitan area. These came from some personal collections. And then a lot of work on the pre-civil rights era in the 30s and 40s when Kansas City built its own hospitals and educational and social institutions.
Will future historians still need these types of images decades from now? I mean, I keep thinking you can find everything these days on the internet, Delia.
You can and you can't. As a historian, I appreciate the opportunity of using the internet because that gives me an opportunity to bring sources to my students when we can't get to particular archives. But there's still a need to collect the physical, even if we eventually have it digitized.
You know, remind us how Black History Month came to be, because I don't think it just popped up in 1976, did it?
No, it did not pop up in 1976. Actually, it goes back to 1926 during the period of segregation. This year marks the 400th anniversary of Africans coming to the U.S. So there's this 400-year history. But if we think about it, a lot of that history has been under slavery and then under segregation. So it was during segregation that the Harvard-educated historian Dr. Carter G. Woodson established National Negro History Week. Mm-hmm. And that week was to honor Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And it eventually grew into a month in 1976. So this was something that was created in the African American community. It was not given, or sometimes you hear the joke that it's the shortest month of the year. But it was February because of the role of Lincoln and the role of Frederick Douglass toward emancipation and freedom that garnered them that kind of honor to make it that first week.
We need to keep celebrating it. Why?
We need to keep celebrating it because of people like William Framborough. There are so many untold stories, African Americans who have invented things that we take for granted each and every day. The fact that our society, our global modern society, was based on a slave economy, the lucrative profits of that. We need to be reminded of those stories because we seem to take it for granted. It's almost forgotten history. And so I think until these stories are told together, there's still a need to focus in February to make sure that we're doing just due to how our society became the way it was.
You know, as you go through these photographs, these old photographs of families, of different church groups, community organizations, what emotion does it spark in you?
A lot of pride. Just a lot of pride. I'm always amazed at what people were able to do under such limited circumstances, under such oppressive experiences. So I always walk away from these images feeling empowered and extremely proud of what the African-American community has done as a community and what they've contributed to the greater good.
Despite all the hardships.
Despite. Yes, yeah. In spite of.
Delia Cook-Gillis presents Through the Photographer's Lens, Kansas City's African-American Community, 2 o'clock Sunday at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. You can RSVP by going to kclibrary.org. Delia, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine is in town. He'll be here with us, and we'll find out why he's here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we learned what Kansas City Chiefs tax documents reveal about the team's bottom line. You can hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, the Missouri Department of Corrections is facing accusations of underreporting assaults on employees and staffing shortages. On Monday, we'll ask the department's director what her agency is doing to turn the thing around. Well, Stephen Miller first met Tim Kaine more than four decades ago here in town. Now Miller is running for Kansas City mayor, and Tim Kaine, who's gone on to represent Virginia in the U.S. Senate, and he just happened to be the Democratic Party's vice presidential running mate in 2016, is back in his old stomping grounds campaigning for his old buddy. Meantime, Kaine's Democratic Party back in Virginia is imploding over allegations that the governor and attorney general once appeared in blackface and that the state's lieutenant governor has been accused of sexual assault. Now, the latest development, the Virginia State Senate's top Republican faces questions about racist photographs and slurs in a college yearbook that he once worked on. It's a giant mess. Senator Tim Kaine joins me now here in the studio. Senator, welcome. So good to have you back in town.
Yeah, Steve, it's great. It's great to be back in Kansas City.
How did you and Steve Miller first meet?
You know, Steve, when I went to Rockhurst High School in the fall of 1972, I was in this—
You didn't want to go there. It was an all-boys school, and that was not your first choice.
I was at Indian Creek junior high, and I told my parents I want to stay at Indian Creek, and they knew better than me. So I went there, and at Rockhurst at the time, and it might still be the way, most of the kids are coming from parochial schools with a group of 20 or 30 friends. Mm-hmm. The public school kids come in, they don't really know anybody. So you're trying to make friends. And literally the first day in the fall of 1972, I met Steve, and we became friends, and we've been friends for 47 years. And my wife Ann and I and his wife Susan, we've just, you know, come along the path of in school and in professional life. And
it's amazing how those friendships endure, the ones you make in high school like that.
They really do. And especially Rockhurst has this ethos of service, broadly defined, not only public service, but just service to mankind. And
right.
They really put that thumbprint on us when we were there. And I really thank God that I had that experience. I know Steve feels the same way.
So you've known him for that long, and yet you still think he'd be a good mayor. And I'm wondering why he'd be a good mayor.
He may blame me later for encouraging him, but Steve first is a person of great values and character. You know, some don't know this about Steve, but when he was a successful lawyer, he took time off from being a lawyer to go back to Notre Dame and study theology, thinking about a career in the ministry, and then decided to return to Kansas City and be a lawyer, but really wanted to inform his life, which for many years was philanthropies, working on cancer-related charities because his wife had fought through a tough battle with breast cancer, working on a program with his dad Christmas in October, which was helping restore people's homes as an annual gift to the community. And then more recently, Steve was asked to serve on the Highway Commission in Missouri. And then I got to know Steve in a different way because I was a new senator, and Steve would come to make the case about infrastructure spending. Huh. And he'd spend time with the Missouri delegation, but he'd usually come and arm twist me a little bit too. Yeah. And I think that experience, Steve, of having that responsibility where you're grappling with what does Kansas City need, but also what does Hannibal need? Sykeston need? And having to figure all that out together really energized him to think about running to be mayor of his hometown.
I was going
to
say he's not held elective office before. Is that a liability or an asset, Senator?
You know, there have been some great people who haven't held elective office, you know, who were great, and it can be an asset. It
Sly
can be a liability.
Sly James, the current mayor here, hadn't held elected office
before. And Sly has not only done a good job, but I think the people look at him as having been a successful mayor. I think the thing that should give people confidence, if you look at Steve, hadn't held elected office, is that Missouri Highway Commission. Mm-hmm. You're probably used to it here, but I'll tell you, Missouri does it differently than anybody else. In Virginia, the governor appoints a secretary of transportation. The Highway Commission has no money except that the governor and legislature decides to give it.
That's interesting.
It changes every 4 years. Here in Missouri, that is an independent organization that has an independent funding source, and the governor doesn't determine what the transportation projects are. The commission does. In Virginia, when I was governor, I determined with my Commonwealth Transportation Board what the projects were. So he's had that experience of working on big, tough issues and having to balance the conflicting needs and demands of different kinds of communities, rural, urban, suburban. And that is an awful lot like what a mayor does.
You know, you grew up here in Overland Park. A lot of folks don't realize that. But what did growing up here do for you? How did it shape a U.S. senator's life?
Wow, that's a big question. Well,
I'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, I have loving parents who are 84, still live in Overland Park. Yeah. My brothers and their families live right down near the plaza. You know, Kansas City is just it was a delightful place to grow up. I mean, I'll give you an example of something that's kind of cool about Kansas City. Not till I went to law school in the East and even moved to Richmond would people say, well, where did you go to college? In Kansas City, when I got out of Rutgers, I was going to college. Oh, you're going to college? That's great. They didn't. People around here didn't give a status issue about
like they do out East. Yeah,
it much different out East. So there's more of a kind of an egalitarian spirit, I believe. That's kind of a Midwestern thing. Second, I grew up in a family where my dad ran an ironworking and welding shop that was union organized by the ironworkers in the stockyards down in KC, and my dad taught us some really important things. He worked really hard, and so my brothers and I do.
He used to get you up like at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, or what did I read about that?
Well, we always worked, you know, in the summers. It was a family business. But I just remember the Saturday morning or the last day of summer vacation when I had plans and my dad like nudging me, hey, you know, we got to go down. I need you today. Well, Dad, I was going to do this. And I just remember, you know, a family business is a family business.
Yeah.
And that means the family has to chip in. And I learned so much from my dad about work ethic. And I also learned the relationship between the owner and labor. His guys were iron worker organized, but he didn't treat that as a competition or an adversarial relationship. His attitude was, look, my business acumen will hopefully put those guys' kids through college, and their artistry is going to put you boys through college, is kind of the way he would teach my brothers and me. And that really, really stuck with me. And I guess that's kind of an egalitarian thing, too. I've given you two examples, but they kind of illustrate the same point.
Well, a lot of people might look at your life and say, you know, you could have become an iron worker, but instead you chose politics. What was wrong with you?
Yeah. What was wrong with – hey, look, that's what my parents thought. I mean, they're still often embarrassed that I'm in politics. I was a civil rights lawyer.
Not anymore, probably. But
well, you know, it depends on the vote, the last vote I cast, you know, and whether they agree with me or not. But
yeah.
I was a civil rights lawyer in Richmond. I moved to Virginia because it's where my wife's from. I was a civil rights lawyer there for 18 years. Got into politics after I'd been there for 10 years. My parents were shocked.
Yeah.
They're non-political people. They're big readers and they're big voters, but, you know, we didn't know anybody in politics.
How do you handle that, Senator, when the family sort of gets on you about a vote you took? I mean, sometimes folks, you know, casual folks
don't
understand.
How come you didn't do better in that debate? Or,
yeah,
you know, something
yeah, what's
like
wrong? Yeah, how do you, is there a rule in the Cain family that don't ask me about what I do in Washington, or how do you deal
no,
with
no, there's
that?
Definitely not that rule in my family.
It comes up all the time.
and the most frequent commentators are my children. So I have three kids and they're, you know, 23, 26, and 29.
Oh,
now, they're letting me know all the time
I bet.
What they think. And my wife spares no effort, too, to let me know what she thinks. You know, it's...
Don't you just want to get away from it, though, when you come home? You don't want to, you know...
Well, that is one of the things I do like about KC, is when I'm here visiting my folks, I can't, you know, go shopping in Richmond without somebody wanting to lobby me about something.
Yeah.
I can hang out with my folks and, you know, go out and grab a pizza and people aren't going to lobby me. So it's restful. And, you know, actually sometimes restful is also conducive to getting work done. Because if you're in the middle of something and you're just on the phone all day and you're not stepping back and, wait a minute, now that I've stepped back from this a half step, I actually can see it more clearly. So sometimes the conversations with mom and dad around the dinner table where I don't have a phone pressed to my ear and I'm not just checking my text every 5 minutes are actually some of the most productive work time I spend, even though I'm not working.
Virginia Senator Tim Kaine is my guest. He's from this neck of the woods. He's here in town to stump for mayoral candidate Steve Miller. So what in the world is going on back in your home state of Virginia? I mean, allegations of the governor in blackface, the attorney general in blackface, the lieutenant governor accused of sexual assault, and now the head of the Senate. I mean, it's Democrats, it's Republicans. Yeah. What's going on?
Well, Steve, here's the way to look at it. This has been a very, very tough week. Other than a week like where I had, you know, family illness or something like that, it's probably been about the hardest week of my life.
I can imagine.
Because people that I care about and a state that I deeply love is really going through a lot of pain. But I look at this situation this way. This is 2019. Right in Virginia right now, we're in the midst of being the centerpiece of a national conversation. 2019 is the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first African Americans.
We just talked about it in our first half today.
Into the English colonies at Point Comfort, which is now Hampton, in August 1619. I authored a bill, the Federal Commission, to talk about the 400th and 400 years of the contributions of Africans and African Americans to our country. But that story is tragedy and triumph and adversity and improvement and backsliding. And so that this is happening and happening in 2019, I sort of don't believe in accidents. We've made a lot of progress. We were the first state to elect an African-American governor. We voted for President Obama twice. But we would be foolish as a Commonwealth or as a country. We would be foolish and naive to say, well, great, we can pat ourselves on the back. These issues of racial insensitivity are in the rearview mirror, or issues of fair treatment of women are in the rearview mirror. And we have been reminded by this. And soon it's not going to just be Virginia. The Washington Post has a story tomorrow. Well, they went and started looking at college yearbooks from colleges all over the country, and they're finding the same kinds of things. So we can this will force us in a very pivotal year when we are already thinking about what this 400 years means, what we've learned and what we haven't. It will force us to have some very, very painful conversations.
You know, I just wrote a column today for the Kansas City Star reflecting back on our former governor here, Mel Carnahan, when he was in the heart of his U.S. Senate race against John Ashcroft in 1999. The revelation came out that Governor Carnahan, back in his mid-20s, had appeared in blackface in a minstrel show down in Rolla, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And it's fat. What I reflected on in the column is the difference in the way what's happening in your state versus what happened here in Missouri. That whole episode sort of was exposed and front page news for a day or two, but it flew by pretty quickly. What's happening in Virginia, it's 20 years later exactly.
Yeah.
It's a different time, different sensitivities, and it's a whole different ballgame with what you're up against
right now. It's completely different. And if there's anything, I'm always looking on the bright side. Is there some good that I can see in this dark situation? Here is a bit of good. Something like this that happened 20 years ago, it probably would have passed by. Virginia voters, Virginia citizens' moral and ethical standards have dramatically changed. That's not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That's not acceptable. Even 25, 30 years ago, this isn't something you did yesterday. It's something you did that's still not acceptable. And I'm glad that things that were acceptable are no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. Now, that means painful conversations, painful decisions. I think if you get the values and principles right, all the politics will take care of themselves. So you don't have to you don't have to think about this in the sense of politics. You have to think about big questions. Racial insensitivity is wrong. You got to call it out. People can grow and change. Treating women badly, assault, harassment, discrimination is wrong. Anybody who's been through that has the right to tell their own story under their own conditions. And you shouldn't either immediately believe every story or immediately discount any story.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole lot of big issues that are at stake as we grapple with this. I've spent much of the last week with our congressional delegation, the Democrats in Congress from Virginia Senate and Congress. There are nine. Two are African American, three are women. We have very different perspectives. We're of different ages. Mm-hmm. We've been in politics for a long time or for a little time. I've spent a lot of time trying to get them on board kind of with a similar way of looking at this. And we reached a statement that we put out last night. But now we're fanning out to the community so that we can try to help bring some order to the situation. It may not directly be about us, but our responsibilities as elected officials in Congress aren't just the vote we cast tomorrow. When the state's hurting, when people are in pain, we got to go out there and be with them and listen to them, and then also try to find a path forward.
Do you know why this is happening now? We're not in the middle of a campaign. Why this week?
Well, it's I have some
it's
belief.
Politics or something.
Well, my understanding, this has been publicly reported, the governor did something unrelated that made some people mad last week, and it dealt with a very contentious discussion on the floor of the General Assembly in Virginia about a bill dealing with abortion.
Abortion, right. Yeah.
And he made a statement about it, made some people mad. And some people who had a copy of this yearbook, and they'd had it for years. But they kind of liked the governor, but they didn't necessarily love his politics, but they liked him and they had it for years. But he did something, made him mad, and then they started it. The three situations are all very different, and they can't be conflated. Each person's situation has to be looked at, you know, on its own light and its own merits. And the way you deal with it, do you express remorse? Do you demonstrate evidence that there has been true remorse? Do you dialogue with the community? All of these things are ongoing in different ways in the three situations, but I'll go back to the point I made a minute ago, which is, and I've made this to my own team, if we focus on principles and policies, then that will lead us to a resolution and the politics will all take care of themselves. If you just focus on politics, we won't solve it and we won't get the politics right either. So these are big and tough enough issues. They're occurring at a time when we're thinking about what it means to have this 400 years of triumph and tragedy of African and African-American contributions to our country. Happens at a time when, thank God, there's a new appropriate sensitivity mm-hmm. to not allowing women to be treated badly and just sweeping it under the rug. Our standards are getting higher. That's good. And we have to, in a time of higher standards, appropriately higher standards, grapple with what the right answer is.
Virginia Senator Tim Kaine is my guest. Let's move on to the government shutdown, Senator. Your state is home to thousands of federal government workers, being as close as it is to Washington, D.C. How confident are you that the country is going to get by without another shutdown in a week or two, especially in light of the president's strong remarks the other night in his State of the Union address that he remains as committed to the wall as ever? The news today suggests there's been some movement in the committee that's dealing with this. What do you expect to happen here?
Steve, here's what my gut tells me. So I'm going to give you intuition more than intel. But I have been talking with the negotiators about this a little bit. I think we're going to reach a bipartisan deal in Congress that will be acceptable to the House and Senate, bipartisan acceptable. I believe the president will sign it. That's not to say that he will be completely happy with the deal.
Well, no one's going to be completely happy if you look at this. Yeah,
The deal will have significant investment for border security done a particular way. Now, the president will get that bill. He'll look to say, do I think that's enough of an investment? Do I like the way they want to make the investment?
My sense is there a wall or is there not a wall?
Right. Is there a wall? Is there a barrier or is it used for something else? But I think my belief is if he gets the bill and he's not happy with that, he's probably, I believe, will sign the bill and then say, but I wanted more and I have other ways of getting more. You know, he's flirted with, could I, through a emergency declaration, access military construction monies that are unspent or disaster relief monies that are unspent? He believes he has some options. Why do I think that's the likely case? It's not just that the negotiators are, I think, getting close to a deal. It's that I think President Trump and the Republican majority in the Senate realize they made a horrible mistake with the shutdown. Longest shutdown in U.S. history. It was shameful. I had a Coast Guard, new Coast Guard, Coastie, we call him, in Virginia, 26 years old, been in 2 years. That means low salary. She was working and no paycheck. And she told me, I buy dog food, not dinner now. I can get by on two meals a day. And in order to buy dog food for my dogs, I have to get by on two meals a day. All she did was volunteer to serve her country in the military, the Coast Guard's branch of the military. And when somebody looks at you and tells you, I buy dog food, not dinner now, or I went to a soup kitchen set up just for federal employees, and I see uniformed FBI agents, uniformed National Park Police waiting outside in the cold so they can get and get their soup or sandwich, it was shameful. I think the president and the Senate Republican majority realizes we do not want to do this again. So the fact that there's a negotiation that seems to be working and the fact of, boy, we really shouldn't do this again, I think that will get us a deal next week. And the president will decide whether or not he likes it. And if he doesn't like it, he may pursue other strategies. Mm-hmm. But I don't think government's shutting down.
I was going to say, if it would shut down again, what does that do to the future of the federal government's workforce? Again, so many of those folks living in your home state, Senator, what would happen then? People are going to say, who wants to work for the federal government?
Oh, it's brutal. It's already had that effect to some degree. And one of the things we're actually negotiating on, Steve, as we're looking at the budget, is could we do an effective anti-shutdown provision that would guarantee it wouldn't happen again? Now, in the middle of the shutdown, I got a bill passed to guarantee back pay, not just for this shutdown, but for any shutdown in the future.
Right.
And so if you're guaranteed that you're going to stroke the check anyway to somebody for working, why lock them out of their office? Let them be in their office serving people.
Right.
We might be able to find a provision that would guarantee no shutdowns in the future. Because if we had another shutdown, I mean, just real quick, one example. Coast Guard. It's a branch of the military, but it's the only branch of the military that doesn't report to the DOD. It's part of DHS. So during the shutdown, because DHS wasn't funded, we're deploying Navy and Coast Guard on military missions together. And the Navy guys are getting a paycheck and the Coast Guard guys weren't for five weeks. So if you're thinking about enlisting today, would you say, let's say I could enlist in one of the five branches. Why would you enlist in the one that just went 5 weeks without pay? So the Coast Guard is really worried, and they do really important work, drug interdiction, rescues at sea. They're already seeing a worrisome effect on even the people who want to serve are more likely to serve elsewhere than to serve the Coast Guard. But that's why we've got to make sure there's never a shutdown again.
Virginia Senator Tim Kaine is my guest. He and Steve Miller, the mayoral candidate, will be at the Westport Flea Market right after this interview for a public town hall. That event is free. Later today at 4, there's a rally featuring the senator at the Miller campaign office, 15 West Linwood Boulevard. You were Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate in 2016. Most people know that. What kind of experience was that for you? Because I had the impression watching you that, you know, that they just didn't let you say a whole lot, Senator.
Well, that was sort of
the deal you made there.
That actually was not the case. My wife and I did 985 events in 105 days.
Oh,
my God. And I assure you, I talked at all of them.
what you talked about, Senator. Yeah.
I would say, you know, obviously, I don't like losing. So that was painful. But the way I talk about the campaign is, man, it was all good except for the last 2 hours, you know.
thought you were going to win until then.
You know what? I was actually among the more wary on the team just for the simple reason. I said, look, there's never been a woman president of this country. That's not by accident. I don't care what the polls say. If there's never been a woman president, if only 20% of Congress is women, and that ranks us about 100th in the world in the percentage of women who serve a national legislative body, you're the underdog. I don't care what the polls say. You're the underdog. So I always kind of had that sense. I did think we were going to win, but I was much more mixed
measured,
about it than
maybe,
some.
Yeah.
But two things about the campaign I'll say that were really amazing. Nobody had been on a ticket before who was fluent in Spanish. I'm fluent in Spanish. So many of my events, many of those 900 plus events were TV, radio, community event speeches purely in Spanish. And people would invariably say, well, nobody has done that before. But once I was on a radio show, Steve, and the host said to me, she said the same thing in a different way. Nobody has been able to listen to us in our own language before. And what it made me realize is it's not that I speak Spanish, because my spoken Spanish, I'm not Cervantes, right? I mean, you know, but it's I can sit in a room with six people and take questions from the audience, and people want to be listened to. This is a fundamental reality, not just about politics, but about life. Nobody feels like they're listened to enough. And I really took away from that little comment, boy, the key job of a mayor, senator, any of us, we got to be good listeners. The other part of the campaign that was a blast is I'm a very amateurish musician. From my days at Rockhurst High School, when I played in a crummy band called the Tennessee Valley Authority with my friends Kent, Pete, and Pat, and we played bad bluegrass music. But for Eastern Kansas, people thought it was good. people figure that out. And so during the campaign, pretty much anywhere I would go, somebody would have a bluegrass band or a blues band or something, and I would get a chance to play with musicians that I've idolized forever. And my wife said, when they ask, you should play, because as soon as you're not in office, you're never getting asked again.
This is your shot. There you go, right? You know, people sometimes recall that vice presidential debate with Mike Pence, and you were like a caged animal unleashed in that thing. And a lot of folks thought, that's not the Tim Kaine we know and love. You were a really aggressive going for the throat. Do you wish you had that thing back again?
Well, you know, you have a job to do. I would say
you have a job to do.
Yeah. And I would say if you never saw me try a case, if you'd seen me try one of my civil rights cases for 17 years in Virginia, you would have recognized that guy.
Okay.
So, you know, they're the right, You know, you don't throw a fastball on every pitch. You throw a changeup, you throw a curve, you throw a fastball. There's different styles for different times. And the one thing I definitely knew going into that debate is a vice president never wins a presidential election, but you got to protect the president,
right.
Presidential candidate.
Right.
And so my main goal in that debate was I'm like a goalie in a hockey net and I'm trying to keep pucks from going in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, look, I thought I could answer this question or that question differently, but we had a strategy that I agreed with. I executed on the strategy. A lot of folks didn't like it. It was funny. I ran into somebody this morning who said, man, I loved you in that debate. I said, I don't get a lot of that, but I mean.
I'll take it. You know, a current issue, Missouri Senator Roy Blunt has a bill out where he's trying to speed up the approval process for federal judges and other federal nominees. As you well know, the backlog sometimes stretches a year or more to get that done. You know, both parties have been guilty of
yes.
sort of slowing down the other team's nominees. But he thinks it's time to move this process along. What do you make of that idea? Is it time to get back to letting the president, whether it's a D or an R, get their nominees into office?
Well, two things, Steve. So the Republicans did change the rules dramatically on the Supreme Court. Democrats had changed on other appointees, and I support these changes that you need 51 votes or 50 plus a tiebreaker to get confirmed, not 60.
Mm-hmm.
Some people didn't like that change, but I actually believe it's the right thing because I think if you're elected president, that comes with a mandate to fill out presidential
It's your time to pick.
But I think once you've made that change, I don't think you need to make more. This president has a fairly historically high track record of not even sending nominees to us. So if you look at how come, you know, some positions aren't being filled, look at the percentage of vacant spaces where the White House hasn't even sent us a nominee.
But still, there's a lot of folks been waiting. There's a guy over in Eastern Missouri waiting for a federal judgeship for almost a year now.
Right. We should all challenge ourselves to be better on that. But the Republicans have the majority, and the Republicans can get somebody through with 51 votes, and they have more than 51.
Right.
And as the majority, they control the floor. Remember, this doesn't have anything to do with the House, which is now majority Democratic. These nominees just come through the Senate. They have the majority. They have the votes. Sometimes they don't necessarily prioritize, we're going to take this position up instead of, you know, tax reform or something else.
Right.
But they get to make the priority about what comes on the floor.
That's Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. Again, he's in town stumping for Steve Miller, the candidate for Kansas City mayor. Senator, thanks for taking time with us. Always
yes,
great
Steve.
To visit with you.
Really treat to visit with you in person.
You bet. On Monday, we meet the director of the Missouri Department of Corrections, and we'll check in on the state of prisons in Missouri. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all. And you are up to date.